Captains James T. Kirk and Jean-Luc Picard have dangled a very special bait before us ever since 1966. While they've intoned the words, space, the final frontier, we have struggled to enter that frontier. Yet our Manichaean thinking has left us divided. On Christmas Eve, 1968, astronauts Frank Borman, William Anders, and Jim Lovell rode their orbiter around the far side of the moon. They were the first living creatures to gaze on that surface. And as they came around the moon, they read aloud to us from Genesis. The words, "In the beginning God created the heaven and the earth," summed up the vast expanse of space. In that moment, the firmament was no longer an abstraction. Hope was immense. A few months later, that small footprint in the moon's dust seemed to tell us we'd completed what we'd set out to do. The culmination did not match our dreams. Thoreau had anticipated our reaction when he wrote, "The youth gets together his materials to build a bridge to the moon, or perchance a palace or temple on the earth, and at length the middle-aged man concludes to build a woodshed with them." Now, however, we might actually build that figurative bridge. A number of straws in the wind suggest a revitalization of our move into space. The great impediment to space travel has been the huge cost of getting free of Earth's gravity. Multistage rockets are inefficient, but as we develop remarkably light and strong new materials, less costly single-stage recoverable rockets seem to be within grasp. Far more remarkable technologies for leaving the clutches of gravity have been suggested as well. In 1979, Arthur C. Clarke wrote a science fiction book, The Fountains of Paradise. A few months later, he included a letter absolving Charles Sheffield of plagiarism at the end of Sheffield's science fiction novel, The Web Between the Worlds. Sheffield, you see, had cooked up the same mad premise that Clarke had. Both authors proposed to replace rocket launches with an elevator, anchored at the equator and reaching up beyond the level of geosynchronous orbit. That's where an orbiting vehicle rides directly over one point on Earth. Clarke congratulates Sheffield for arriving at the idea independently. If the idea sounds crazy, bear in mind that both Clarke and Sheffield were distinguished scientists before they turned to science fiction. Clarke was a noted astronomer. Sheffield was the chief scientist of the Earth Satellite Corporation. Both used science fiction to promote space travel. Their elevator was to be a cable with an extremely high tensile strength, strong enough to support its length of over 22,000 miles. It was to be a single perfect crystalline carbon or silicon fiber. Today we're closing in on carbon nanotube materials that should be even stronger, and we routinely put geosynchronous satellites into orbit. Above the geosynchronous level, a satellite will fly away from Earth, and below, it will fall back down. So the cable above pulls on the cable below, holding it in place. The cable would be tapered, thickest at the point of geosynchronous orbit, where the stresses would be greatest. I won't describe all the technology that Clarke and Sheffield suggest to make such a thing work, or how they plan to put it in place, anchor it, and counterweight it above the geosynchronous level, or how they propose to pass the energy of rising and falling cars back and forth. But their proposals are very similar because they obey the same laws of physics. In fact, Russian engineers and others had already suggested the idea. The Russians called it a cosmic funicular. NASA calls it a space elevator. You might incline to laugh this off as too grand to take seriously. However, in 2002, NASA sponsored a conference for exploring design issues involved in building a space elevator. And the echoes of the Thoreau quotation about building a bridge to the moon are suddenly too strong to ignore. Many such ideas have lain dormant for years and are only now resurfacing. Photon propulsion, extended human dormancy during long space journeys, and so forth. However, what's really been dormant for so long are not scattered elements of a space program, but the determined desire to get ourselves out there. We shall regain that desire, and we shall set off on a far grander scale than anything we've seriously contemplated. When we do, perhaps we can quit miring ourselves into the morass of self-consuming troubles that have created such disillusion here on Earth. The other emergence that promises once again to kickstart human energy is the emergence of radical new physics. Henry Adams heralded the immense human energy of the 20th century when he told us that we were facing the eruption of forces totally new. He also told us that we are about to rediscover mystery. And we did so in the reason-defying logic of quantum mechanics and relativity theory. Now a new yawning pit of implausibility opens up before us. Every day we read some new article about superstring theory, loop theory, dark matter, alternate universes, quantum computation, the cosmic anthropic principle, new implications of chaos theory upon our perception of reality, and simultaneous communication between particles, all being backed up with new evidence. We stand again on the threshold of mystery, just as we did in 1900. Once more, our world is about to become unrecognizably larger than it was. Once more, hope wells up from a great ocean of untapped but inchoate possibility. Something is about to happen. Time and space are once more ready to turn and change and to take us up to new mysteries and new heights, if only we let them do so. It is truly an extraordinary time to be alive. I'm John Leinhart at the University of Houston, where we are interested in the way inventive minds work.